Hi, Dave Emery here. This is, for the record, program number 875, update on Ukraine. This is being recorded on November 19th of the year 2015. As the title fairly directly indicates, we are updating our coverage of things going on in Ukraine. In the description for the record program number 875, there will be an enumeration of the many programs we have done to date about Ukraine going back to early 2014 following the Maidan coup. Suffice it to say for the time being that there is way too much information that we have downloaded and archived for us to do justice to what we have spoken about. In a nutshell, or perhaps a 155-millimeter shell might be more appropriate, given what has been taking place. Following a very obvious coup d'etat, and what is frankly a matter of public record, thanks to statements by State Department officials about Ukraine, the coup itself was basically the result of a covert operation in Ukraine, and the upshot of that coup d'etat was to return to power the heirs to the OUNB, that is a Ukrainian fascist organization that was allied with the Third Reich. It then allied itself with the Western intelligence and played a significant role, a very significant role, in the Cold War. It was very closely allied with the CIA, with the BND, the West German Intelligence Service, and the successor to the Reinhardt-Galen spy outfit, and also had strong links to British intelligence as well. It also was the primary element in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, which in turn was one of the central elements in the former World Anti-Communist League. The ABN was actually formerly known as the Committee of Subjugated Nations. It was formed by the Nazis in 1943 and then jumped to Western intel, including and especially BND and CIA. And we're going to begin by a nice chunk of this program will be the reading of an article about a synoptic account of an important new book about the OUNB and its head, Stefan Bandera. What we're going to be doing, though, for the opening of the program is discussing the identity of the chief of Ukrainian intelligence beginning in the early 2014 following the Maidan coup. That fellow's name is Valentin Valentyn Nalivaichenko, Nalivaichenko. I may be mispronouncing his name. Nalivaichenko is inextricably linked with Pravi Sektor, one of the direct and self-proclaimed ideological heirs to the OUNB. And not surprisingly, he has used his position as the chief of the SBU, the Ukrainian Intelligence Service, not to purvey accurate intelligence, but rather as a combination of propaganda, rather naked pro-OUN and anti-Russian propaganda, and also to coordinate actions euphemized as anti-terrorist actions. Apparently, those anti-terrorist operations, unquote, are characterized by the burning of some 40-odd anti-government and pro-Russian demonstrators in the Union Hall in Odessa in May of 2014. We have also noted in the past the systematic assassination, euphemized as suicides, unquote, and accidental deaths, unquote, of critics of the current Ukrainian government. I think it is a pretty good bet that Mr. Navalny and private sector lie at the foundation of those actions as well. As we noted in For the Record 781, the Yushchenko regime that came to power under the after the so-called Orange Revolution under Viktor Yushchenko in many ways was on the one hand the result of OUNB activism and also paved the way for the further propagandizing in an Orwellian fashion of not only the current events in Ukraine, but also the Ukrainian past. The SBU files under Yushchenko were placed under the control of a fellow named Volodymyr Vyatrovich, who headed up the Institute for National Memory, basically an Orwellian organization that was devoted to fundamentally perverting Ukrainian history. He has been appointed in a similar fashion to a similar post, basically continuing in that capacity, by Petro Poroshenko. The events in Ukraine are altogether stunning because what we have seen under the a provision of the so-called lustration laws, which are ostensibly anti-corruption, but which have also basically criminalized any criticism of the OUNB and have, as a result, criminalized any accurate portrayal of World War II history in Ukraine and much of Eastern Europe. It is stunning and Orwellian in its dimensions, and perhaps the most ominous aspect of it is that the West has been going along with this. That really is not all that surprising because the actions in Ukraine, as we have looked at in For the Record 778 and 777, 778 and 781, were to project the OUNB back into Ukraine. Viktor Yushchenko's Orange Revolution resulted in the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko, a fellow named Roman Svarich, becoming Minister of Justice, the equivalent of Attorney General. Yaroslav Stetsko was the head of wartime Ukraine, World War II, the World War II puppet government in Ukraine. And he basically was the fellow who did Stefan Bandera's bidding and perpetrated Nazi-style atrocities against Jews, Poles, and Russians in Ukraine. The First Lady of Ukraine under Yushchenko was none other than Ekaterina Chumachenko, or the former Ekaterina Chumachenko. She was a top OUNB operative, a member of the UCCA, the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, the top OUNB front organization in the U.S., headed up by Lev Dobryansky, who later became Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas. His daughter Paula Dobryansky was on Reagan's National Security Council and then became an undersecretary of state or an assistant secretary of state under George W. Bush. After Ekaterina Chumachenko was Reagan's deputy director of public liaison, she then became First Lady of Ukraine. And again, under Yushchenko, the SBU files were placed under the control of an OUNB activist named Volodymyr Vyatrovich, and who headed up the Institute for National Memory, which was every bit as Orwellian as it sounds. He has continued in that capacity. And Roman Zvarich, the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko in the early 1980s, is an advisor to Petro Poroshenko. Yushchenko's chief of intelligence, the head of the SBU under Yushchenko, was Valentin Nalivaychenko. He then became a member of parliament, and when Petro Poroshenko was elected president, he was reappointed as, or when the Maidan coup took place, he was reappointed as head of Ukrainian intelligence. He was replaced last July. There was infighting over the maneuvering around various corrupt oligarchs in the Poroshenko regime. And Nalivaychenko was ultimately replaced. However, it's worth noting that this, the fellow we're about to describe, is the head, or was the head, of Ukrainian intelligence during most of the period that we have been covering the Maidan coup and the reinstitution of the OUNB forces in Ukraine. We're going to begin with our discussion of Nalivaychenko by repeating some information we spoke about in For the Record 781. This is from a chapter of a book called Analyzing Fascist Discourse, European Fascism in Talk and Text, edited by Ruth Wodak, W-O-D-A-K, and John E. Richardson, R-I-C-H-A-R-D-S-O-N, published in hardcover by Routledge Press, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, London and New York. And this is a chapter called The Return of the Ukrainian Far Right, The Case of V.O. Svoboda. And as we have seen, Svoboda is one of the OUNB heirs in Ukraine. And of Nalivaychenko and his role under Yushchenko, we read, a reconstructed historical memory is created as true memory, unquote, and then contrasted with, quote, false Soviet history, unquote. Thus, Valentin Nalivaychenko, SBU director under Viktor Yushchenko, described the task of his agency as being to disseminate, quote, the historical truth of the past of the Ukrainian people, unquote, and to, quote, liberate Ukrainian history from lies and falsifications, and to work with truthful documents only, unquote. Ignoring the OUN's anti-Semitism, denying its participation in anti-Jewish violence, and overlooking its fascist ideology, Nalivaychenko and his agency presented the OUN as Democrats, pluralists, even righteous rescuers of Jews during the Holocaust. And again, this is truly Orwellian. By the way, I would note that Viktor Yushchenko and Petro Poroshenko both placed wreaths of tribute to the OUNB at the Babi Yar Ravine. That was the site of a famous Holocaust massacre, actually a series of massacres of Jews, Gypsies, and I think there were also some Poles. But scores of thousands of people were shot to death, and although there were German executioners there as well, two-thirds of the executioners were from the OUNB. So when you have Viktor Yushchenko and Petro Poroshenko going to Babi Yar and laying tribute to the OUNB, that would be like attending, going to Auschwitz and placing a wreath in commemoration of the SS. It is grotesque in and of itself. It's really beyond Holocaust denial. It's Holocaust celebration. And perhaps the most ominous aspect of it, and indeed the most ominous aspect of the Orwellian nature of what is taking place in Ukraine, is the fact that the West is going along with this.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Also, grotesque is the fact that Poland has essentially been adopting a pro-OUNB, pro-Poroshenko, pro-Maidan stance, and indeed the Poles were among those who were the victims of OUNB butchery. From the Blogmire blog by Rob Slane, S-R-A-N-E, of April 11th of 2015, Poland stretches out its hands to the freedom fighters, unquote. And they, obviously, the author is being deeply sarcastic, talking about the freedom fighters. Excerpting this, unfortunately, the Ukrainian authorities show no signs whatsoever that they are about to abandon their admiration of those responsible for these horrific crimes, talking about the butchery of Poles during World War II by the OUNB. Continuing, to the contrary, they seem to be intent on admiring them all the more, as the SBU head Valentin Nalivachenko's recent words indicate. SBU does not need to invent anything extra. It is important to build on the traditions and approaches of the OUN-UPA Security Service. It, the OUN-UPA Security Service, worked against the aggressor during the temporary occupation of the territory. It had a patriotic upbringing, used a counterintelligence unit, and had relied on the peaceful Ukrainian population using its support. By the way, the UPA is the Ukrainian Partisan Army, which ultimately jumped to Western intel as well and actually continued the combat of World War II as guerrilla fighters until the early 1950s in Ukraine. So again, Valentin Nalivachenko had operated the SBU not only as an Orwellian propaganda unit, but along the lines of the OUNB. Of the relationship between Nalivachenko and Dmytro Yarosh, the head of Pravi Sektor, we read the following. This from the Eurasia Daily of June 25th of the year 2015. The leader of the right sector extremist group, Dmytro Yarosh, believes that the dismissal of the chief of the security service, Valentin Nalivachenko, was both illogical and untimely. He writes in Facebook that Nalivachenko is his friend who has raised the security service from zero and has neutralized lots of terrorist threats all over the country. Quote, I know what I am talking about, as my right sector was involved in many of his special operations against Russian terrorists, Yarosh said. In the past, Yarosh was Nalivachenko's advisor. And more about the relationship between Nalivachenko, the head of Ukrainian intelligence during the bulk of the Maidan and post-Maidan period, from the very conservative and largely pro-Maidan Atlantic Council website. From June 18th of 2015, an article by Brian Mefford, M-E-F-F-O-R-D, switching spy masters amid war is risky. Valentin Nalivachenko, head of the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU, is in trouble again. On June 15th, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said he was, quote, unsatisfied, unquote, with Nalivachenko's work. 3 days later, Ukraine's parliament dismissed him. Poroshenko bloc MP Sergei Leshenko, S-E-R-H-I-Y-L-E-S-C-H-E-N-K-O, released a document confirming old rumors that right sector's Dmytro Yarosh worked for Nalivachenko while he was a member of parliament from 2012 to 2014. While the connection between the two raises some questions about the events of Euromaidan and the origins of right sector, this attack alone wasn't enough to discredit Nalivachenko. Yarosh is now a member of parliament and an advisor to the chief of general staff of the Ukrainian army. In other words, Yarosh has been legitimized by the political establishment. By the way, in the provisional government following the Maidan coup, Yarosh was the deputy defense minister. He is now again an advisor to the head of the Ukrainian army. There are Chechen Islamist fighters associated with ISIS now fighting under the administrative command of Pravi Sektor in Ukraine. And I was really very surprised from what the Atlantic Council bloggers, again, they're very pro Maidan, pro-Ukraine, and by extension, pro-OUNB, in effect. It says, well, the connection between the two, meaning Yarosh and Nalivaychenko, raises some questions about the events of the Euromaidan and the origins of right sector. Well, it does more than raise questions. It bloody well provides answers to those questions. And what we're going to do next is to, because I appreciate that, and this is not in any way to be patronizing, for many people, and I think that this applies to so many of the journalists who have been covering the events in Ukraine, names like Stefan Bandera, the OUNB, and so forth, are simply unknown. They don't know who they are, and so therefore they are left with trying to sift through the propaganda that has been disseminated by various Western intelligence services and by some of the State Department and other American and European governmental officials that have been talking about events in Ukraine. There is a recent book called Stefan Bandera, The Life and Afterlife of a Ukrainian Nationalist. It was published by Gregorz Rosolinski Liba. That's G-R-Z-E-G-O-R-Z, R-O-S-S-O-L-I-N-S-K-I, hyphen L-I-E-B-E. And what we are going to do is to read an article that is a good summation of that. This article is by Daniel Lazare, L-A-Z-A-R-E, from the Jacobin, J-A-C-O-B-I-N, magazine of September 24th of 2015. Who was Stefan Bandera? And this article, I think, will not only talk about who Bandera was, I think it presents a very good summation of the lack of understanding of this by Western media people, and I think is a very useful overview on the historical reality that is being deliberately stood on its head by people like Valentin Nalivaychenko, Volodymyr Vyatrovich, Petroshenko, and others. Again, from Jacobin Magazine, Who Was Stefan Bandera? By Daniel Lazare. Lionized as a nationalist hero in Ukraine, Stefan Bandera was a Nazi sympathizer who left behind a horrific legacy. When Western journalists traveled to Kiev in late 2013 to cover the Euromaidan protests, they encountered an historical figure that few recognized. It was Stefan Bandera, whose youthful black-and-white image was seemingly everywhere, on barricades, over the entrance to Kiev's city hall, and on the placards held by demonstrators calling for the overthrow of then-President Viktor Yanukovych. Bandera was evidently a nationalist of some sort and highly controversial, but why? The Russians said he was a fascist and an anti-Semite, but Western media were quick to disregard that as Moscow propaganda. So they hedged. The Washington Post wrote that Bandera had entered into a tactical relationship with Nazi Germany, unquote, and that his followers, quote, were accused of committing atrocities against Poles and Jews, unquote, while the New York Times wrote that he had been, quote, vilified by Moscow as a pro-Nazi traitor, unquote, a charge seen as unfair, again quoting, in the eyes of many historians and certainly to Western Ukrainians. Foreign Policy dismissed Bandera as, quote, Moscow's favorite boogeyman, a metronym for all bad Ukrainian things, unquote. Whoever Bandera was, all were in agreement that he couldn't have been as nasty as Putin said he was. But thanks to Gregorz Rosolinski Liba's Stefan Bandera, The Life and Afterlife of a Ukrainian Nationalist, it now seems clear. the terrible Russians were right. Bandera was indeed as noxious as any personality thrown up by the hellish 1930s and 1940s. The son of a nationalist-minded Greek Catholic priest, Bandera was a sort of self-punishing fanatic who sticks pins under his fingernails to prepare himself for torture at the hands of his enemies. As a university student in Lvov, he is said to have moved on to burning himself with an oil lamp, slamming a door on his fingers, and whipping himself with a belt. "Admit, Stepan," he would cry out. "No, I don't admit," unquote. Again, he's torturing himself here. A priest who heard his confession described him as, quote, "an ubermensch who placed Ukraine above all," unquote. While a follower said he was the sort of person who, quote, "could hypnotize a man. Everything he said was interesting. You could not stop listening to him," unquote. Enlisting in the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, at age 20, he used his growing influence to steer an already violent group in an even more extreme direction. In 1933, he organized an attack on the Soviet consul in Lvov, which only managed to kill an office secretary. A year later, he directed the assassination of the Polish Minister of the Interior. He ordered the execution of a pair of alleged informers, admirals responsible for other deaths as well, as the OUN took to robbing banks, post offices, police stations, and private households in search of funds. What sent Bandera off in such a violent direction? While Selinsky Lieber's massive new study takes us through the times and politics that captured Bandera's imagination. Galicia had been part of Austria-Hungary prior to the war, but whereas the Polish-controlled western half was incorporated into the newly established Republic of Poland in 1918, the Ukrainian-dominated eastern portion, where Bandera was born in 1909, was not absorbed until 1921, following the Polish-Soviet War and a brief period of independence. It was a poor fit from the start. Bitter at being deprived of a state of their own, Ukrainian nationalists refused to recognize the takeover and, in 1922, responded with a campaign of arson attacks on some 2,200 Polish-owned farms. The government in Warsaw replied with repression and cultural warfare. It brought in Polish farmers, many of them war veterans, to settle the district and radically change the demographics of the countryside. It closed down Ukrainian schools and even tried to ban the term Ukrainian, unquote, insisting that students employ the somewhat more vague Ruthenian instead. When the OUN launched another arson and sabotage campaign in the summer of 1930, Warsaw resorted to mass arrest. By late 1938, as many as 30,000 Ukrainians were languishing in Polish jails. Soon, Polish politicians were talking about the extermination, unquote, of the Ukrainians, while a German journalist who traveled through eastern Galicia in early 1939 reported that local Ukrainians were calling for, quote, Uncle Führer, unquote, to step in and impose a solution of his own on the Poles, that, of course, being Hitler. The conflict in the Polish-Ukrainian borderlands exemplified the ugly ethnic wars that were erupting throughout Eastern Europe as a new world war approached. Conceivably, Bandera might have responded to the growing disorder by moving to the political left.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Previously, liberal Bolshevik cultural policies in the Ukraine, Soviet Socialist Republic, had caused a surge in pro-communist sentiment in the neighboring Polish province of Volhynia, that's V-O-L-H-Y-N-I-A. But a number of factors got in the way. Bandera's father's position in the church, the fact that Galicia, unlike formerly Russian Volhynia, was an ex Habsburg possession and hence oriented toward Austria and Germany, and of course Stalin's disastrous collectivization policies, which by the early 1930s had completely destroyed the Soviet Ukraine as any sort of model worth emulating. Consequently, Bandera responded by moving even farther to the right. In high school, he read Mykola Mikhanovsky's, M-I-K-H-N-O-V-S-K-Y-I, a militant nationalist who had died in 1924 and preached a united Ukraine stretching, quote, from the Carpathian Mountains to the Caucasus, unquote, one that would be free, quote, of Russians, Poles, Magyars, Romanians, and Jews, unquote. Entry into the OUN a few years later exposed him to the teachings of Dmytro Dantsov, the group's spiritual father, unquote, another ultra-rightist who translated Hitler's Mein Kampf and Mussolini's La Doctrina del Fascismo and taught that ethics should be subordinate to the national struggle, unquote. Entry into the OUN also plunged him into a milieu marked by growing anti-Semitism. Anti-Jewish hatred had been deeply bound up with the concept of Ukrainian nationhood since at least the 17th century, when thousands of Ukrainian peasants, maddened by the extractions of the Polish landlords and their Jewish estate managers, engaged in a vicious bloodletting under the leadership of a minor nobleman named Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Ukraine was a scene of even more gruesome pogroms during the Russian Civil War. But anti-Semitic passions rose a further notch in 1926 when a Jewish anarchist named Sholom Schwarzbard assassinated the exiled Ukrainian leader Simon Petliura in Paris. "I've killed a great assassin," declared Schwarzbard, who had lost 14 family members in the pogroms that swept through the Ukraine when Petliura headed up a short-lived anti-Bolshevik republic in 1919 and 1920, on surrendering to the police. But after hearing testimony from survivors about impaled babies, children cast into flames, and other anti-Jewish atrocities, a French jury acquitted him in just 35 minutes. The verdict caused a sensation, not least on the Ukrainian right. Dantsov denounced Schwarzbard as, quote, an agent of Russian imperialism, unquote, declaring, "Jews are guilty, terribly guilty, because they helped consolidate Russian rule in Ukraine, but, quote, the Jew is not guilty of everything," unquote. Russian imperialism is guilty of everything. Only when Russia falls in Ukraine will we be able to settle the Jewish question in our country in a way that suits the interest of the Ukrainian people. While the Bolsheviks were the main enemy, Jews were their forward striking force, so the most effective way of countering one was by thoroughly eliminating the other. In 1935, OUN members smashed windows in Jewish houses and then, a year later, burned around 100 Jewish families out of their homes in the town of Kostopil in what is now western Ukraine. They marked the 10th anniversary of Petliura's assassination by distributing leaflets with the message, quote, "Attention, kill and beat the Jews for our Ukrainian leader, Simon Petliura. The Jews should be removed from Ukraine. Long live the Ukrainian state," unquote. By this point, Bandera was already in jail serving a life sentence following a pair of highly publicized murder trials in which he taunted the court by giving the fascist salute and crying out, "Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine," unquote. Parenthetically, that is the cry that was extant during the Maidan coup. It is the cry of the OUNB. Continuing. But Bandera was able to escape following the German takeover of Western Poland beginning on September 1, 1939, and making his way to Lviv, the capital of Eastern Galicia. But the Soviet incursion on September 17th sent him fleeing in the opposite direction. Eventually, He and the rest of the OUN leadership settled in German-controlled Krakow, about 200 miles to the west, where they set about preparing the organization for further battles still to come. The Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, which the OUN leadership seems to have gotten wind of months ahead of time, was the moment they had been waiting for. Not only did it promise to free the Ukraine from Soviet control, but it also held out the prospect of unifying all Ukrainians in a single state. The dream of a greater Ukraine would thus be realized. A month earlier, Bandera and his chief lieutenants, Stefan Lekovsky, Stefan Shukievich, and Yaroslav Stetsko, had put the finishing touches on an internal party document entitled "The Struggle and Activities of the OUN in Wartime," unquote, a to-do list for when the Wehrmacht crossed the Soviet border. By the way, it says here the OUNB seems to have gotten wind of the invasion by Germany. The OUNB had been working with German intel for a long time in our visit, specifically in 838, for the record, 838 and 839 with Peter Lavenda. We have spoken about the Pelopenko affair, in which a Ukrainian Orthodox priest named Pelopenko, who was an agent for the Gestapo and the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, had been very active in the U.S. and around the world, and he in many ways, Pelopenko, that is, embodied the relationship between Third Reich Intel and the SS and the OUNB. Continuing with the account here of the struggle and activities of the OUN in wartime. It called on members to take advantage of the favorable situation, unquote, posed by a war between Moscow and other states, unquote, to create a national revolution that would draw up all Ukraine in its vortex. It conceived the revolution as a great purification process in which, quote, Muscovites, Poles, and Jews, unquote, would be destroyed, in particular those who protect the Soviet regime. Although the OUN regarded the Nazis as allies, the document stressed that OUN activists should commence the revolution as soon as possible so as to present the Wehrmacht with a fait accompli. We treat the coming German army as the army of allies. We try before their coming to put life in order on our own as it should be. We inform them that the Ukrainian authority is already established. It is under the control of the OUN under the leadership of Stefan Bandera. All matters are regulated by the OUN, and the local authorities are ready to establish friendly relations with the army in order to fight together against Moscow. The document continued to quote, "It is permissible to liquidate undesirable Poles, NKVD people, informers, and provocateurs, all important Ukrainians who in the critical time would try to make, quote, their politics and thereby threaten the decisive mindset of the Ukrainian nation," unquote, adding that only one party would be permitted under the new order, that party being the OUN. Although Bandera and his followers would later try to paint the alliance with the Third Reich as no more than, quote, tactical, unquote, an attempt to pit one totalitarian state against another, it was in fact deep-rooted and ideological. Bandera envisioned the Ukraine as a classic one-party state with himself in the role of Führer or Pravidnik, and expected that a new Ukraine would take its place under the Nazi umbrella, much as Joseph Tiso's new fascist regime had in Slovakia, or Ante Pavelic's in Croatia. Certain high-ranking Nazis thought along similar lines, most notably Alfred Rosenberg, the newly appointed Reich Minister for the Occupied Eastern Territories. But Hitler was obviously of a different mind. He saw Slavs as, quote, an inferior race, unquote, incapable of organizing a state, and viewed Ukrainians in particular as, quote, just as lazy, disorganized, and nihilistic Asiatic as the greater Russians, unquote. Instead of a partner, he saw them as an obstacle, obsessed with the British naval blockade of World War I, which had caused as many as 750,000 deaths from starvation and disease. He was determined to block any similar effort by the Allies by expropriating Eastern grain supplies on an unprecedented scale. Hence, the importance of the Ukraine, the great granary on the Black Sea. I need the Ukraine in order that no one is able to starve us again like in the last war, he declared in August of 1939. Grain seizures on such a scale would mean condemning vast numbers to starvation, 25 million or more in all. Yet not only did the Nazis not care, but annihilation on such a scale accorded perfectly with their plans for a racial makeover of what they viewed as the Eastern frontier. The result was the famous Generalplan Ost, the great Nazi blueprint that called for killing or expelling up to 80% of the Slavic population, and its replacement by Volksdeutsche, settlers from old Germany, and Waffen-SS veterans. Plainly, there was no room in such a scheme for a self-governing Ukraine. When Stetsko announced the formation of the Ukrainian state, quote, under the leadership of Stefan Bandera in Lvov, just 8 days after the Nazi invasion, a couple of German officers warned him that the question of Ukrainian independence was up to Hitler alone. Nazi officials gave Bandera the same message a few days later at a meeting in Krakow. Subsequently, they escorted both Bandera and Stetsko to Berlin and placed them under house arrest. When Hitler decided on July 19, 1941, to partition the Ukraine by incorporating Eastern Galicia into the general government, unquote, as Nazi-ruled Poland was known, OUN members were stunned. Instead of unifying the Ukraine, the Nazis were dismembering it. When graffiti appeared declaring, "Away with foreign authority, long live Stefan Bandera," the Nazis responded by shooting a number of OUN members and by December of 1941, placing some 1,500 under arrest. In a letter to Alfred Rosenberg in August of 1941, Bandera offered to meet German objections by reconsidering the question of Ukrainian independence. On December 9th, he sent him another letter pleading for reconciliation. Quote, German and Ukrainian interests in Eastern Europe are identical. For both sides, it is a vital necessity to consolidate or normalize Ukraine in the best and fastest way, and to include it in the European spiritual, economic, and political system, unquote. Ukrainian nationalism, he went on, had taken shape, quote, in a spirit similar to the National Socialist ideas, unquote, and was needed to spiritually cure the Ukrainian youth, unquote, who had been poisoned by their upbringing under the Soviets. Although the Germans were in no mood to listen, their attitude changed. This is fundamental now, because again, the Nazi regime was altogether brutal, and there were sharp divisions within even the SS about how, quote, non-Aryans, unquote, were to be treated. There was the so-called Black or Northern SS, which viewed Southern Europeans and others as inferior. However, as combat on the Eastern Front proceeded, the attitude shifted, and eventually, and this is fundamental for our understanding of the history, the OUNB became a very important arm of the Third Reich and the SS and the Gestapo, and basically implemented not murderous Nazi policy in Ukraine and Poland. And ultimately, the OUNB became a key element of the Committee of Subjugated Nations. That was a consortium of Eastern European fascist groups like the OUNB, the Croatian Ustashi, the Romanian Iron Guard, the Bulgarian National Front, and others. And that again, had been formed in 43 by Hitler. It was renamed the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, ultimately that Third Reich conceived organization, again, an ally of the Third Reich, jumped to Western Intel, CIA, BND, and British intelligence, and became a key element of the former World Anti-Communist League.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
So again, continuing with this important history of the Ukraine. By the way, we also should note what an utter hell broth Eastern Europe was following World War One, after the disbanding of the Austro-Hungarian and Russian empires. There was a series of brutal ethnic wars in Eastern Europe that have already been fairly well summarized by this article. Now, continuing with this very important story. Although the Germans were in no mood to listen, their attitude changed once their fortunes began to shift. Desperate for manpower following their defeat at Stalingrad, they agreed to the formation of a Ukrainian division in the Waffen-SS known as Galician, which would eventually grow to 14,000 members. Rather than disbanding the OUN, the Nazis had meanwhile revamped it as a German-run police force. The OUN had played a leading role in the anti-Jewish pogroms that broke out in Lvov and dozens of other Ukrainian cities on the heels of the German invasion, and now they served the Nazis by patrolling the ghettos and assisting in deportations, raids, and shootings. But beginning in early 1943, OUN members deserted the police en masse in order to form a militia of their own that would eventually call itself the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA. Taking advantage of the chaos behind German lines, their first major act was an ethnic cleansing campaign aimed at driving Poles out of eastern Galicia and Volhynia. When it comes to the Polish question, this is not a military but a minority question, a Polish underground source quoted a UPA leader as saying, "We will solve it as Hitler solved the Jewish question," unquote. Citing the Polish historian Grzegorz Motyka Rosalinski-Liba says, that the UPA killed close to 100,000 Poles between 1943 and 1945, and that Orthodox priests blessed the axes, pitchforks, scythes, sickles, knives, and sticks that the peasants it mobilized used to finish them off. Simultaneously, UPA attacks on Jews continued at such a ferocious level that Jews actually sought the protection of the Germans. Quote, "The Banderite bands and the local nationalists raided every night, decimating the Jews," a survivor testified in 1948. "Jews sheltered in the camps where Germans were stationed, fearing an attack by Banderites. Some German soldiers were brought to protect the camps and thereby also the Jews," unquote. Rosalinski-Liba carries the story of Bandera and his movement through the Nazi defeat when the Galician division fought alongside the retreating Wehrmacht and then into the post-war period when those left behind in the Ukraine mounted a desperate rearguard resistance against the encroaching Soviets. This war after the war was a deadly, serious affair in which OUN fighters killed not only the informers, collaborators, and Eastern Ukrainians transferred to Galicia and Volhynia to work as teachers or administrators, but their families as well. "Soon the Bolsheviks will conduct the grain levy," they warned on one occasion. Anyone among you who brings grain to the collection points will be killed like a dog and your entire family butchered, unquote. Mutilated corpses appeared with signs proclaiming for collaboration with the NKVD, unquote. According to a 1973 KGB report, more than 30,000 people fell victim to the OUN before the Soviets managed to wipe out resistance in 1950, including some 15,000 peasants and collective farm workers, and more than 8,000 soldiers, militia members, and security personnel. Even given the barbarity of the times, this group's actions stood out. Parenthetically, it is this guerrilla warfare. Many of the OUNB units still had their Waffen-SS and Wehrmacht officers and advisors with them. This was actively aided by the Office of Policy Coordination and the elements of CIA. We talked about this in, among other shows, AFA program number 1 and in, for the record, program number 777. It is this group of people that author John Loftus referred to as the fascist freedom fighters. Not just the OUNB, by the way, but other fascist groups that were used by Alan Dulles and Frank Wisner in the early Cold War. Continuing. Stefan Bandera is an important book that combines biography and sociology as it lays out the story of an important radical nationalist and the organization he led. But what makes it relevant, of course, is the OUN's powerful resurgence since 1991. Although Western intelligence eagerly embraced Bandera and his supporters as the Cold War began to stir, quote, Ukrainian emigration in the territory of Germany, Austria, France, Italy, in the greatest majority is a healthy, uncompromising element in the fight against the Bolsheviks, unquote, a U.S. Army intelligence agent noted in 1947. The movement's long-term prospects did not seem to be very promising, especially after a Soviet agent managed to slip through Bandera's security ring in Munich in 1959 and kill him with a blast from a cyanide spray gun. Parenthetically, this is actually incorrect. The evidence suggests actually that the murder of Stefan Bandera by Bogdan Stashinsky was actually done by some element of Western intel, probably BND, maybe an element of CIA, and it is linked to the assassination of President Kennedy. We will talk about that in For the Record 876. Continuing. With that, the Banderites seem to be going the way of all other captive nations, far-right exiles who gathered from time to time to sing the old songs, but who otherwise seem to be relics from a bygone era. What saved them, of course, was the Soviet collapse. OUN veterans hastened back at the first opportunity. Stutzko had died in Munich in 1986, but his widow, Slava, returned in his place, according to Rosalinsky Liba, founding a far-right party called the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists and winning a spot in parliament. Yuri Shukievich, the son of the exiled UPA leader Roman Shukievich, established another ultra-right group calling itself the Ukrainian National Assembly. Even Bandera's grandson Stefan made an appearance touring Ukraine as he unveiled monuments, attended rallies, and praised his grandfather as the, quote, symbol of the Ukrainian nation, unquote. A homegrown group of Banderites, meanwhile, formed the Social National Party of Ukraine, later known as Svoboda. In a 2004 speech, their leader, the charismatic Oleg Tyanovich, paid tribute to the fighters of the UPA. The enemy came and took their Ukraine, but they were not afraid. Likewise, we must not be afraid. They hung their machine guns on their necks and went into the woods. They fought against the Russians, Germans, Jews, and other scum who wanted to take away our Ukrainian state. And therefore, our task for every one of you, the young, the old, the gray-headed, and the youthful, is to defend our native land. Except for the omission of the Poles, the speech was an indication of how little things had changed. The movement was as xenophobic, anti-Semitic, and obsessed with violence as ever, except that now, for the first time in half a century, thousands of people were listening to what it had to say. One might think that the liberal West would want nothing to do with such elements, but the response was no less unscrupulous than it was during the opening years of the Cold War. Because the Bondarevichi were anti-Russian, they had to be democratic. Because they were democratic, their ultra-right trappings had to be inconsequential. The Bandera portraits that were increasingly prominent as the Euromaidan protests turned more and more violent, the Volksangel that was formerly a symbol of the SS, but was now taken up by the Azov Battalion and other militias, the old OUN war cry of glory to Ukraine, glory to the heroes that was now ubiquitous among anti-Yanukovych protesters, all had to be ignored, or discounted, or whitewashed. Unquote. And again, there is a good deal of history in there about the hellbath that took place in Europe during the immediate post-World War I period, and that forged many of these things. Again, people in the West are not really aware of, you know, friction between Poland and the Ukrainians, or how what we now call Ukraine was at one point part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, then part of Poland, parts of it were part of the Soviet Union, then all of it was the Soviet Union, then all of it belonged to Nazi Germany. There is an historical lie that is being disseminated, which is that the OUN actually fought against Nazi Germany. This is not true. They did declare their independence. They were hoping to be a satellite state, and when the Nazis took over, they did basically intern Stefan Bandera, but he was treated very, very well, and the SS basically incorporated significant elements of the OUNB. This is not unlike other elements of Third Reich infighting. Ultimately, even Erwin Rommel himself, the famed Desert Fox, arguably Germany's most skilled general in World War II, fell before Nazi firing squads when the divisions within the Third Reich became so great that there was a centripetal effect. And ultimately, the SS solidified things under the rule of Hitler. We're going to continue with our analysis of events in Ukraine during the next couple of programs. And for the record, 876, we are going to talk about the OUNB and the assassination of JFK. There are a great many other things taking place with regard to Ukraine. However, those are going to wait for future broadcasts. This concludes For the Record program number 875, Update on Ukraine. This is being recorded on November 19th of the year 2015. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.